All right. Good morning, everybody. Good morning, all you magnificent melon heads of the world. Happy Wednesday, everybody. Today is March 4th, 2026. And man, what a difference a day makes. Yesterday, we had pandemonium ahead of the opening bell, and shortly after, the Dow dropped over 1,200 points in the opening minutes yesterday, only to see the dip buyers show up and regain control. The market ended up closing down a more respectable 400 points, still a big drop, but way off the lows that we saw in the morning. So the dip buyers kind of seized the initiative yesterday, and it looks like this morning, I don't want to jinx it. I really don't want to, but it looks like this morning we've got calm has been restored. In most places, South Korea is freaking out. We'll get to that one. But at the moment, we've got stocks are a little bit higher after the big swing yesterday. We've got oil is down a little bit off its highs. We've got Dutch TTF gas futures way down from the highs we saw yesterday. We've actually got rumors swirling that some peace overtures were made through back channels between Iran and the U.S. Now, there's a lot of grain of salt, a big old grain of salt to be taken with that, but that rumor was enough to send the dollar down quite a bit from the highs that we saw yesterday. The DXY is a little bit lower. Look, the dogs and cats, they're getting their own places this morning. They're going their separate ways. You know, they tried the whole roommate thing. It didn't work. The mass hysteria has somewhat settled down. Everywhere except South Korea. All right, we got to talk about what's going on in South Korea, because South Korea may be giving us a little bit of a preview of what an actual popping of the AI bubble could start to look like. And it's not pretty. South Korea just had its worst one-day sell-off since the 2008 global financial crisis. The Kospi index was down 12% in a day. That's the index, guys. We're not talking about penny stocks here. We're talking about an index dropping 12% in a day. That is on top of Tuesday's big drop that we talked about yesterday. Circuit breakers were triggered again. Tech stocks leading the way. Memory stocks leading the way. The memory stocks just went absolutely bonkers last year because of the AI bubble and Sam Altman bidding up the price of RAM memory and the shortages. We all know about that. You can't. Consumer electronics are getting more expensive. They're worried about phone production. It's a mess in memory markets. Well, apparently people took that information and they just ran a little too far with it. The South Korean market was grotesquely levered up. A lot of people went out on margin. A lot of people borrowed money and bought stocks. And, well, the phone started ringing yesterday. The margin man called. South Korea had a violent deleveraging over the last 2 days. No end in sight. All right, we're not sure if we're done there. We've only sold off to prices we were trading at in South Korea like the beginning of February. It was really only a few weeks of leverage has been burnt out here. So we'll have to wait and see what happens tomorrow, what continues to happen there. But, you know, as much as the whole world, and I use this term loosely, right, the world is calm. Missiles are still flying. People are still dying. But financial markets are much calmer than they were yesterday, with that one exception on the Korean Peninsula. Now, as we said, the missiles are still flying. We do still have a war going on here, and supply problems are starting to spring up. Capacity curtailment, force majeures getting declared. The effects of the Strait of Hormuz being closed are only now starting to be felt. We're going to talk about some of those. We have force majeure being declared. Places like Bahrain aluminum markets, they have announced that they're not able to fill their contracts because of the strait being closed. Qatari LNG plants, they are shutting down. I'm sure somebody said something about my pronunciation right there, so sue me, I don't get out much. Yeah, the LNG plants in Qatar, they're going down because of force majeure as well. We've got talk about capacity curtailment at Indian fertilizer plants because they can't get their hands on that LNG that's used to make fertilizer. So you can see how if this conflict continues to drag on, it could eventually spill over in agricultural commodities markets if the fertilizer is having issues, much like we saw in the 2022 invasion of Ukraine. We've got storage tankers are filling up all across the Middle East, places like Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Qatar, the UAE. If it continues, if they can't get the tankers loaded and through the strait, they're going to have to start shutting down oil production. And shutting in oil wells is a major operation. It's not a switch that you just turn off. It's actually really expensive, and it takes a lot of time to spin it back up. So we still haven't seen much in the way of supply curtailment and supply destruction yet. We've seen a lot of worries about that spilling into prices, causing some volatility, but we're only just now starting to see the first signs of that actual disruption spreading into other areas of the market. Now, even as all of that is going on, we have got the United States is now saying, President Trump announced yesterday, he's directing the U.S. government to pretty much ensure traffic through the Strait of Hormuz. The U.S. Navy is going to escort the ships somehow. We tried to do it in the Red Sea, and it was marginally effective. They were only ever able to restore about half of the container ship traffic through the Red Sea. They didn't really get freedom of navigation back during that conflict. And the Iranian IRGC is not the Houthis. They are arguably much more powerful than the Houthis. It's going to be a risky proposition, and it's going to be expensive that the United States would somehow insure traffic through the Strait of Hormuz, as in like financially insure it. The U.S. government will pay you if your boat gets hit with what money? Probably printed cash. It also raises the question, why the hell is the United States government going to insure oil tanker traffic that's bound for freaking China? Why would we do that? Maybe let the Chinese insure their own freaking tankers? I just throw it out there. I'm not keen on the idea of U.S. sailors putting their lives on the line and U.S. finances guaranteeing the flow of oil into freaking China, who is, you know, that's the next place we'll send young men to die. So that's going on this morning. And look, even as we're having all these supply curtailments and this thing's happening at ship, you had an Iranian frigate got torpedoed. You had a container ship got hit in the Strait of Hormuz. The crew had to abandon ship. Everybody's accounted for, at least on that boat. The Iranian frigate crew was not so lucky. It looks like a submarine torpedoed them. That was off of Sri Lanka. And we also had a Russian LNG tanker got hit by surface drones, like basically drone boats, launched by the Ukrainians off the coast of Malta, and the drones were launched from Libya. And that story is a lot to unpack there, because we are seeing war at sea, guys. Boats have been attacked for a while now in the Ukraine conflict. You've got obviously plenty of naval combat going on in Iran. You've had plenty of tankers have been hit between Ukraine and Iran. We've had problems with tankers getting seized in Europe with the Russian shadow fleet. We had tankers getting seized in Venezuela. We had small boats blowing up in Venezuela. Now we've got a Russian LNG tanker operating in the Mediterranean Sea off the coast of Malta getting hit by Ukrainian drones launched from Libya. You know, the seas are a mess. As much as markets are calm, you know, trade is under attack worldwide here. It really does appear to be spreading, if not escalating. All right, that's enough about the military conflict. What else we got going on? Yesterday, this was kind of interesting. It happened to almost no fanfare. Only some people on Twitter were talking about it. The Federal Reserve's ACH system went down yesterday. ACH stands for Automated Clearinghouse. That's direct deposits. That's, you know, transfers between checking accounts. The system went down around noon yesterday. It came back a few hours later. It's working now, but nothing in the press. Nobody's talking about what happened. There's been a lot of hoopla and a lot of theorizing and a lot of wefers out there making speeches about cyber attacks. We had a crack in the crypto exchange was welcomed into the Federal Reserve rail system yesterday as well. Maybe that had something to do with it. We don't know. But when the Federal Reserve's ACH system goes down, you'd think they would say something other than it's down. You think they'd talk about what caused it, unless maybe they don't want us to know what caused it. I don't know. But it's back, and nobody's talking about it. What else we got? ADP private payrolls came out this morning. They were pretty good. They weren't great. Some downward revisions to last month. We'll get the jobs numbers later this week. But at the very least, they weren't terrible. And in this job market, I think that passes as good. We got more news about that BlackRock BCRED redemption surge. We talked about that yesterday. Blackstone. It's a very easy mistake to make. Blackstone's BCRED private credit firm, private credit fund. They had record redemptions. They met the redemptions, but it's how they met the redemptions, where they got the money. That's interesting that they're talking about this morning. Some might say that looks desperate. And last but not least, we've got the Lumber Exchange building in Minneapolis. Shout out to FC Nightingale, who posted this one. You'll never guess what this building sold for, this price. It is rather amazing what this building sold for. And well, I'll just give you a little clue about what the price was. We're so back. We are so back. Stick around to the end of the show for that one. I kid you not. You won't believe what this building sold for. Guys, we got a lot to talk about today. Let's shrink my big melon of a head and see what's going on in the world of finance. Don't forget that like button and that subscribe button. And don't forget your tickets to George Noble's Best Stock Ideas Summit, where yours truly will be presenting on March 11th. That's only a few days from now. At the moment, the S&P 500 is up 25 points or 0.37% higher. Stocks appear to be in the green this morning. The Dow is up 148 points, 0.31% higher, recovering even more of those losses from yesterday. Again, started down 1,200 yesterday, closed down 400, got 150 back here. So over the last couple of days, stocks have actually held up pretty well. The NASDAQ is down 138 points, 0.56% in the green. Indexes are up all three. That is all except South Korea. Panic sweeps Korean stocks in biggest one-day crash on record. Okay, so I got it wrong in the monologue. It is the biggest two-day crash since the GFC, but yesterday was the biggest one-day crash in history for South Korean stocks. What is going on over there? Panic swept through South Korea's trading floors as concerns over the Middle East conflict sent the world's hottest stock market to its biggest ever sell-off. The KOSPI index plunged 12% following a 7.2% drop on Tuesday as heavyweight Samsung Electronics, SK Hynix, and Hyundai Motor tumbled. The rout triggered a 20-minute trading halt early on Wednesday. Of more than 800 stocks in the benchmark, only 10 finished green. A key volatility gauge jumped to its highest level since 2008. From Wall Street strategists to mom-and-pop traders, few saw it coming. Oh, you might even say nobody saw this coming. Optimism on artificial intelligence and the ensuing demand for memory chips was so strong that retail investors were piling in with borrowed money and analysts were raising their already bullish calls on Korean equities. Then came the Iran war. While the conflict has dragged down equities worldwide on concern that higher oil prices will stoke inflation, Korea's losses have been exacerbated by a record buildup of margin debt. Leveraged wagers that once magnified gains are now accelerating declines as heavy borrowing turns into forced liquidation with prices in free fall. And that's important, guys. Prices are in free fall, and they do not appear to be stopping. These are daily candles. First of all, look at the ridiculous run-up in South Korean stocks that we've seen since early last year. I mean, this index is denominated in Korean won, but we were about 2,500 to over 6,300. All right, up by about 150% in 8 months. And this is the index, not a shitcoin. This is the index. And then, of course, you can see, look at this violent two-day deleveraging, including this most recent candle, the biggest one-day sell-off in history for South Korean stocks. And it's still above the 50-day moving average. That's what's rather amazing. Down 7% and change Tuesday, 12% today. Still above the 50-day moving average. You think just maybe this one got a little out over its skis? Just a little bit? At some point, you can expect a dead cat bounce here, but I don't know, man. I think this has a lot further to go. The memory stocks just went berserk on this AI bubble. And, well, that AI bubble doesn't have long to live. So coming soon to a NASDAQ near you. Who knows when? Not today. Also, we've got the DXY is lower, rather sharply lower this morning, 98.89, off by 17 basis points. Now, the dollar has been ripping since the conflict broke out in Iran. You had two big days of high double-digit gains in the DXY. We were over 99 yesterday. So the Dixie is a lot weaker today. What's going on with this one? And we've got this one from Bloomberg this morning. Dollar slides most in a month after report on Iran outreach. All right. Okay, let's take this one with a grain of salt, but hey, at least there's a rumor of peace talks, so we got that going for us. The dollar fell the most in nearly a month after a New York Times report said Iranian operatives had offered to discuss terms for ending the war. Notice they're saying Iranian operatives. We don't really know who's in charge over there, just these are operatives. They do operations. They operate. Okay. The Bloomberg Dollar Spot Index extended earlier losses, weakening as much as 0.4% before pairing the move. The gauge had surged 1.4% over the previous two sessions as the spiraling Middle East conflict reignited inflationary fears and drove demand for haven assets. The report should be taken with a grain of salt, said Evelyn Gomez-Lechty, a strategist at Mizuho International, given the attempt to negotiate was reportedly made a day after the attacks began, while U.S. officials were described as being skeptical of the approach. All right, so there's some important details there. The attempt was made a day after the attacks began. That means this was on Sunday. All right, and things got pretty wild on Monday and Tuesday over there. So, you know, we have a rumor of something that supposedly happened right after the war began, that some operatives, we don't even know if they really have the authority to negotiate, but at least somebody over there is interested in an end to the shooting, and the market took that and ran with it, and the dollar actually weakened quite a bit on that story. Meanwhile, we've got the bond market mostly green on yields this morning, which means some more bond selling going on this morning, especially at the long end of the yield curve. The 30-year yield is at 4.724%, down 2 points and change. The 10-year is down almost 2 points to 4.074%. We've got the 2-year yield is at 3.517, off by 1 point and change. And the 1 month is at 3.698, unchanged for the day. A little bit of volatility still in bonds, although no real big moves here. We've seen a couple of basis point moves. The dip buyers also bought the bonds yesterday too. And one thing that they were buying yesterday, they were buying Bitcoin, and they're buying it again this morning. What the hell, guys? We got World War III breaking out in the Middle East and Europe. We've got disruptions in the Strait of Hormuz, and Bitcoin is ripping? What? Okay, well, there it is. Risk on. $71,629 for Bitcoin as priced on Coinbase. Higher by $3,200 this morning. I mean, who looks at what's going on in the world right now and says, yeah, let's go buy Bitcoin? Maybe the Fed ACH system going down has something to do with it. You know, that's obviously not good for the traditional finance system. So plenty of the Bitcoin maxis were out complaining about that yesterday. Maybe the fact that you got a lot of people looking to get their money the hell out of Dubai right now, and the easiest way to move wealth across invisible lines is Bitcoin. So maybe that's contributing. We do have an article about how much people are paying to get out of the UAE right now. That could be contributing. Whatever it is, Bitcoin having a really good day here. Looking at the commodities market, we've got some green in metals this morning. By the way, shout out to my friend Bob Coleman from Idaho Armored Vaults, who came on the show last night. We did an impromptu live stream to try to make heads or tails out of the price action in gold and silver yesterday. And Bob had some pretty interesting things to say about Jane Street a couple of minutes into that video. So thanks again, Bob, for that one. And I highly recommend you guys check that out in the feed. But right now, the gold market is higher by $80, $5,169 for spot gold, 1.58% higher. April COMEX gold futures are at $51.79, higher by $55, or about 1.1%. Spot silver looking a little better than yesterday, $84.41, higher by a paltry $2.33, or 2.8% higher. I like to see the smaller moves in silver and in the right direction. I don't want these $10 intraday swings anymore. That only helps Jane Street. May silver contracts are at $84.53 on the COMEX. That's higher by $1.02, or 1.25%. I like the shiny, even if the silver market is a freaking hot mess right now. Copper is 1.25% higher. Platinum, 3.8% higher. Palladium, 2.5% higher. And crude oil is taking a break this morning. We're actually down about 50 cents, 0.7%, $74.05 for April WTI futures. And Brent crude is also down about 32 cents at $81.07 for May Brent futures. All right, let's take a look at a couple of these charts, shall we? This is the WTI crude oil chart. And you can see we had a big spike at the open Monday that, you know, then people calmed down and sold off. We had another big spike yesterday. We went very briefly into the high 70s. We were threatening $80 in WTI. Eventually, that calmed down a little bit. And now we're down this morning a little bit, essentially pretty much right where we opened up on Monday. So it's been a heck of a round trip for oil prices here at $74. We have some other stories coming up in a minute here about supply worries that could influence this chart. But first, let's take a look at Dutch TTF natural gas futures, because this is another one of those indexes that has been going wild. Natural gas in Europe got a lot more expensive in the first 2 days of this week. That volatility is continuing this morning, but it's down about 4.5% here, 51.85. That's euros per megawatt hour this morning, well off the highs we saw of almost 64 euros per megawatt hour yesterday. So even natural gas futures starting to settle down a little bit here. So we've got a couple of articles about what's going on in the Strait of Hormuz this morning. Let's start with this one. Treasury Secretary Bessent says the U.S. will make a series of announcements to support the oil trade in the Gulf. The spice must flow. That is the takeaway from this one. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said Wednesday, Washington will roll out a series of measures aimed at stabilizing oil shipments through the Persian Gulf, signaling that the government is prepared to step in as geopolitical tensions threaten one of the world's most critical energy corridors. We have a series of announcements that we're going to be making, Bessent said on CNBC. We began yesterday with the announcement that the DFC, that is the Development Finance Corporation, that's a arm of the U.S. government that helps finance projects around the world, the DFC will provide the insurance for both crude carriers and cargo ships operating in and around the Gulf over the weekend. Over the weekend, that's interesting. Does that mean they're going to start it over the weekend, or we're only going to, you know, 2 days only? We're only going to have an insurance on Saturday and Sunday? I don't know. That's a little bit of a wishy-washy statement. But the U.S. government is providing both military and financial guarantees to ships traversing the Strait of Hormuz. That's interesting. That's going to be expensive. But hey, we've got a money printer. Am I right? I guess we'll just debase the currency if we have to. That seems to be the takeaway here. Now let's talk a little bit more about what's going on as these supply disruptions are happening. We've got oil production shutdowns loom as some Middle East countries could run out of storage. And Trump says the Navy may escort tankers through the Strait of Hormuz. Some Middle Eastern countries are only a few days from running out of storage for their crude oil, giving new significance to President Trump's vow on Tuesday that if necessary, the Navy will escort tankers through the Strait of Hormuz to unkink that key shipping lane. Speed and decisiveness are critical, as tightening storage constraints mean delays will quickly translate into forced shut-ins, said analysts at JP Morgan in a note on Tuesday. Trump also said in a True Social post that he ordered U.S. government political risk insurance and guarantees for the financial security of all maritime trade, especially energy traveling through the Gulf. All right, so we're just going to insure every boat on the water now. Sure, why not? Money is infinite, right? And it doesn't matter how much we print. In their note, the JP Morgan analysts refined earlier predictions about storage as the strait continues to be essentially closed. While some countries, such as Saudi Arabia, have abundant storage, enough for more than 30 days of oil in some scenarios, others, such as Iraq and Kuwait, are looking at only a few days before they hit key storage limits and are forced to cut production. JP Morgan estimated that Iraq and Kuwait would have 3 and 14 days, respectively, of crude storage available. Analysts said they were conservative in assessing storage limits, which don't include some potential storage sites and massive oil tankers that could be used as storage vessels, although those are also thin on the ground, per reports. I don't really know what thin on the ground means when it comes to storage vessels, but what they're saying here is, look, there's other places we could put oil if it was really an emergency. We could start loading empty ships. It's just not somewhere you want to be, especially not with missiles targeting ships all over the Gulf. Let's try to not have an ecological disaster while we're having a humanitarian and geopolitical CF. If Hormuz remains effectively closed, supply losses would accelerate, the JP Morgan analyst said, with shut-ins to the tune of 3.3 million barrels per day by the conflict's potential eighth day to nearly 5 million barrels a day by day 18. So that's how much oil could be disrupted. Global oil consumption is somewhere between 100 and 120 million barrels a day. So we are looking at a significant amount of global oil production would have to be shut down if we don't get the strait moving. The government estimates that around 20 million barrels per day of crude oil and petroleum products pass through the strait in times of peace. And we're already starting to see this spill over into other industries as well. India's urea producers trim output as Iran disrupts LNG flows. Fertilizer manufacturers in India are beginning to cut output after Qatari supplies of liquefied natural gas, a key feedstock, were suspended due to hostilities in the Middle East. Some manufacturers, like Indian Farmers Fertilizer Cooperative, have started reductions at certain urea plants, according to people familiar with the matter, who asked not to be identified. Any prolonged disruption may compel companies to shut facilities, the people added, without providing details. LNG is the primary feedstock for the production of urea, serving as both an energy source and a key input in the manufacturing process. India's production cuts come as supply disruptions ripple through commodities markets, raising prices and stoking broader economic concerns. Rising prices of other raw materials used to make fertilizers such as ammonia and sulfur are also adding to fears of higher production costs. It's not just India here. Pakistan's Sui Northern Gas Pipeline has also informed customers that it will be unable to supply regasified LNG to their fertilizer plants due to the Middle East conflict, according to a company notice seen by Bloomberg. The country receives most of its LNG from Qatar, and the suspension takes effect from midnight on Wednesday. So this is already starting to spill over into fertilizer markets in India and Pakistan. And we're also seeing it in aluminum markets now. Aluminum Bahrain declares force majeure on contracts. Aluminum Bahrain, or ALBA, on Wednesday declared force majeure on its contracts because it is not able to ship, the spokesperson said. It's because of what's happening in the Strait of Hormuz. We're not able to ship. So we're producing, but the metal is here in ALBA, the spokesperson told Reuters. ALBA, which has one of the world's biggest aluminum smelters, produced 1.62 million metric tons of aluminum in 2025. So you can see here, I mean, this isn't something people normally watch for, but war in the Middle East driving up the price of aluminum is now officially a thing. Here we can see since the start of the war in the last three trading days, we started around 3,077 at the close on Friday. We went as high as 3,360 or so in the aluminum price, and I'm guessing this is U.S. dollars per ton here, but we have had a pretty significant move higher over the last 3 days, and that is going to get worse the longer this lasts, especially since the ample supplies from Bahrain are not able to reach the market. That could spill over into things like food packaging, aircrafts, and automobiles. Keep an eye on those industries. And it's not just boats in the Middle East. This story is kind of crazy because this is nowhere near the front lines. Russian gas carrier attacked in the Mediterranean Sea by Ukrainian unmanned boats. A Russian gas carrier was attacked in the Mediterranean Sea by Ukrainian unmanned boats, and all 30 Russian crew members have been rescued, the Russian Transport Ministry reported. On March 3rd, a Russian vessel, the gas carrier Arctic Metagas, was attacked in close proximity to territorial waters of the EU member Malta. The tanker was carrying cargo documented in full compliance with all international regulations and was en route to Murmansk. Okay, yeah, that's a Russian ministry statement here. The attack was carried out from the Libyan coast using Ukrainian unmanned boats, the ministry added. Thanks to coordinated actions by Maltese and Russian rescue services, all 30 crew members who are Russian citizens were rescued. So thankfully, no loss of life, but that's pretty wild here that the Russian-Ukraine war has now reached off the coast of Malta with Ukrainian drones launched from Libya. Did not have that on my 2020s bingo card. Boats of all shapes and sizes all over the world appear to be fair game in this conflict, guys. And I want to send a shout out to Peter Campbell, who is a transport correspondent with the Financial Times. He posted this on Twitter this morning. Look at what people are doing to get out of Dubai right now. And keep this in mind with that big move that we've seen in Bitcoin. And also keep in mind, Dubai is a big crypto hub, and Bitcoin is the easiest way to move wealth in the world. Nothing is easier. If you can remember 23 words, you can move Bitcoin, any amount of it, anywhere in the world. The cost of leaving Dubai just hit $250,000 for a family as taxi and private jet prices soar. Private jet companies say more families are taking their pets, showing they're leaving properly. In other words, they're not coming back if they're taking pets. Let's see. The total cost of evacuating one family with two adults and two children ranged as high as $250,000, one insurer said. For employers who end up using private jets, prices for charter planes have roughly doubled since the weekend, according to people in the industry. The cost of hiring a taxi or a private hire minibus to drive from Dubai to Muscat in Oman or Riyadh in Saudi Arabia, the two most popular destinations for those fleeing the city, has risen to thousands of dollars, up from a few hundred before the weekend. I saw numbers as high as what was it, $6,000 for a six-hour car ride from Dubai to Saudi Arabia. That is one hell of an Uber payday. Look how desperate people are to get out of Dubai here. And I can't help but think that's probably got something to do with Bitcoin this morning. All right, the story nobody's talking about outside of Twitter, that is. Thousands impacted as Federal Reserve faces transaction delays and issues. This one from yesterday. The Federal Reserve was hit with transaction issues on Tuesday, but the problems were resolved by the afternoon. Federal Reserve Financial Services confirmed the transactions issues had been resolved in an update at 1:41 p.m. Customers can now return to normal processing of Fed ACH services. That's Automated Clearinghouse. We value your business and apologize for any inconvenience caused by this operational issue. The issue appeared to be with the Fed ACH services suite, which provides financial institutions with effective low-cost batch payment services that enable an electronic exchange of debit and credit transactions through the ACH network. In a noon update, the Federal Reserve wrote that ACH services were experiencing delays associated with internal systems processing. Blah, blah, blah. It's commonly used for financial institutions for direct deposits of payroll, Social Security benefits, according to the Federal Reserve. While the network was originally used to process mostly recurring payments, the network today is used extensively to process one-time debit transfers, such as converted check payments and payments made over the telephone and the internet. It was unclear what caused the issues or when the services would be restored to normal. Well, I can tell you this is the Federal Reserve's website right here, frbservices.org, and you can see Fed ACH is currently green. It's working. So they got it back up, but they never told us what happened. And, you know, I've been hearing all this stuff about, hey, cyber attacks, we need to be aware of cyber attacks. And all of a sudden, ACH goes down and nobody's willing to tell us what happened. I don't know. Do we need to put the tinfoil hat on to be like, hey, maybe somebody hacked the Federal Reserve? And if they did hack the Federal Reserve, would they tell us? Hell no. Of course they wouldn't tell us. It would freak people out. So, yeah, that happened yesterday. That's fun. On to private payroll data. Private businesses in the U.S. added 63,000 jobs in February of 2026, according to ADP. That is the most since July. Hey, that's not bad. Following a downwardly revised 11,000 rise in January and above forecasts for 50,000. Before we get into this, the sectors here, let's address that downward revision because the number was originally reported last month at 22,000. And so they downwardly revised that to 11,000. These are not government statistics, mind you guys. This is private data. So, you know, ease up on the tinfoil a little bit, especially because the price of aluminum is rising because of force majeure in Bahrain. But I digress. So if we subtract the 11,000 in downward revisions from the 63,000 number that was just reported, you end up with 52,000. And they're saying, okay, this was better than the 50,000 the market was forecast. This was basically in line with expectations if you factor in the downward revisions. All right, so let's talk about the sectors. Education and health added 58,000, leading all sectors. Nothing new there. We have an aging population. Healthcare is the one industry that's consistently hiring. Construction added 19,000 jobs. There's your data centers getting built. Wasted capital, big tech's CapEx money burning. 19,000 jobs. Thank you very much. Information was up 11,000. Financial activities up 2,000. Natural resource and mining up 2,000. On the other hand, white-collar jobs, professional business services shed 30,000. Manufacturing lost 5,000. Again, guys, the pain from tariffs will get here long before any benefits ever potentially arrive. Manufacturing lost jobs once again. Trade, transport, and utilities was down 1,000. Small establishments created 60,000 jobs, and large companies added 10,000, while medium shed 7. All right, so we get better jobs data. We get the ADP payrolls later this week. But for now, I mean, that's better at least, right? It wasn't dreadful. And considering some of the recent numbers we've seen in the labor market, I'm going to call this one a win. All right, let's talk about what happened at Blackstone. We mentioned yesterday about how the redemptions at the BCRED private credit fund, the publicly traded one, not publicly traded, the retail investor one, that it was surging. Well, now it turns out Blackstone senior staff had to open their wallets with the flagship private credit fund that was under pressure. The money for the redemptions, it didn't come from selling assets. It came from the guys who managed the fund. It was their personal money. Executives at Blackstone had a decision to make. Like its rivals in the $1.8 trillion market for private credit, redemptions were piling up for its flagship private credit fund. To help weather the withdrawals, the firm turned to old-fashioned door knocking internally. In the end result, more than 25 senior leaders from across Blackstone, many from its credit business, pitched in some $150 million to the Blackstone private credit fund, according to people familiar with the matter. Combined with the $250 million of the firm's own capital that helped cover a record redemption request of roughly $3.8 billion, or the equivalent of 7.9% of the assets. And guys, when I see this, I can't help but be reminded of Evergrande back in 2022 when they were going door to door, putting social pressure on their employees, trying to get their employees to reinvest their paycheck into Evergrande's wealth management products, telling people if you didn't invest in these, you would be dealt with, right? When you're tapping your own employees' personal funds for liquidity, oh, that's a great sign, right? That's a good thing. 25 senior leaders kicked in $150 million. The money proved crucial in allowing BCRED, an $82 billion investing behemoth, to pay out investors without changing the terms of its tender offer, a move that investors could have received badly in this more febrile time. Somebody want to tell me what febrile means, please? I'm sorry, I don't have my thesaurus handy. But hey, how come nobody's talking about selling assets? How come everybody's like, oh, this was better than gating investors? How about you sell some of the loans in your books? If they're really worth what you tell us they're worth, go sell one instead of putting your own personal money in there. I mean, this looks like, I don't want to get myself in trouble here, but this looks like Ponzi schemers looking between the couch cushions to meet redemptions here. The measure underscores the length managers are going to quell retail investor fears about cracks in the industry. Across the market, redemption requests are expected to breach the 5% limit more frequently in the coming months, leaving insiders saying it's fast becoming a game of who will blink first. Blackstone employees providing the exit liquidity. I guess it's better than retail investors and grandma's annuity. Sure. All right, last one of the day. Shout out to FC Nightingale from Nightingale Associates on X and our own Pasta Man who sent me this one. Another visit to the commercial real estate market. How bad is it, you ask? Well, it's funny you should ask. The historic Lumber Exchange building in Minneapolis, Minnesota, where I'm told things are just awesome these days, has sold for, drumroll, $1 a buck. The property last sold in 2019 for slightly more than that, $24.3 million. City assessors last year estimated its value at $11.3 million. The seller, an entity tied to Minneapolis-based Varda Partners, had been trying to offload the property for more than a year. The investment firm acquired the Lumber Exchange in 2023 after the prior owner, an entity tied to Chicago-based real estate firm R2, defaulted on its mortgage and forfeited the deed to avoid foreclosure. All right, so in 2023, they default on the building. Right? They don't pay their loan. Here's the keys. All right, so the lender seizes the building and he gets a dollar for it. All right, let's talk a little bit more about that. All right, so that is a 225,000 square foot building built in 1885. It's an old building, probably needs a lot of work. 225,000 square feet. You can fit a lot of Leering centers in this building. It sold for 44 ten-thousandths of a cent per square foot. That's some discount property there. And the property sold for $1. And by the way, I have it on good authority that a photographer was actually able to infiltrate the closing on this property where this picture was taken. If you know, you know. What can I say? We're so back. $1. Oh, yeah. But don't worry. Commercial real estate has bottomed, guys. Hey, I just want to say thank you very much to the Jolly Lollipop who says, Jack, are DCI bonds a good bet right now? I say no. Give me one second here. What a decent... the Deposit Corporation of Israel. Sorry, guys, I'm not going there. I'm just not going to go there. Some people see a Star of David hiding behind every story. I just not really interested, Jolly. Sorry. I don't own any. That's the only thing I can tell you there. All right, thanks again, Jolly Lollipop, for supporting the channel. Pelican2W1 says... he became a YouTube member. Welcome, Pelican. Hey, look at the Pelicans. Look at the Pelicans. What movie? Let me know in the quotes. Man, a lot of movie quotes today. Thank you, Pelican, for supporting the channel. I appreciate that very much. Welcome to the Melonheads. Oh, we got more Melonheads inbound. Nacho Man, thank you, sir, for supporting the channel with 20 more. Nacho, I appreciate the support of the channel very much, sir. You are a gentleman and a scholar. Welcome to the Melon Patch, you 20 baby melons. What else we got here? Nacho Man is again. Thank you, Nacho Man. He says, congratulations on 73,000, Jack. You be awesome. Sure, I'd be awesome. I'm Jack Gamble, and I approve this message. Thank you to every single one of you 73,000 wonderful Melonheads who have subscribed to the channel. Thank you, guys. Welcome to you new guys, by the way. And hey, while we're at it, all you other new guys who haven't yet hit that subscribe button, what are you waiting for? How about now? Good a time as any. Thanks again, Nacho Man. Mr. 4Ps says, what's Jack's bingo card have on it next? How about syphilitic salamanders attacking southern San Antonio? I don't know. We don't have a lot of time to think about these things. It's a live show, and there's no do-over. So, yes, syphilitic salamanders attacking southern San Antonio. Now, how do salamanders survive in the desert in San Antonio, Texas? I don't know. I mean, that just goes to show you how crazy this freaking decade is. Sure, that is next on my 2020s bingo. I don't get a lot of time to think about these. Thank you, Four Piece. EJ Walsh 877 says, tinfoil analysis. Okay, we are at the ready. Shiny metals price swings alert or start in Asia, continue in London. LME owned by Hong Kong Exchange, no conflict of interest. So I've been trying to nail this one down. I've seen a lot of metal, and Bob talked about this yesterday in our live stream. A lot of metal has been leaving the Shanghai exchanges. And I think I wrote down the number on the Shanghai Futures Exchange. What was it? There was 900, I think it was 900 tons, if I had to guess as the units there. I only wrote down the numbers. 900 tons in December. As of February, there were 350 tons. And according to Bob, they stopped reporting that, or at least they're still reporting it, but the 350 tons hasn't moved over the last few months, which suggests they're not reporting it. They're just rehashing the old measurement. So the Hong Kong metal, not the Hong Kong metal, the Shanghai metal has been trading at a significant premium above the London metal. So you'd think metal would be flowing into that exchange, but it's leaving. I don't draw too many signals from what's going on in China, to be honest with you. I think it's a paper market that's just being moved around by ETFs and futures. And, you know, I get it. Ours resembles that as well. But there's a lot more physical metal in the London and the New York markets than there is in China. It's a new market, and it's the Wild West. Now, the Hong Kong exchange, I realize we're talking about Hong Kong, and the whole answer was on Shanghai. I don't really delineate between the two because nothing happens in Hong Kong without the blessing of the Chinese government these days. So is it a conflict of interest? Sure. I would say, guys, if you're looking to get a little tinfoil with the metals exchanges and with what's going on in paper markets, I think you really want to take a hard look at Jane Street. Jane Street is in trouble for manipulating stocks with high frequency trading in India. They're being sued here in the States for manipulating Bitcoin and the IBIT exchange. And they're also the biggest holder of the SLV ETF. And Bob painted a pretty gruesome picture of just how illiquid the CME market is right now, or the futures exchanges, because of these big increases in margin requirements. A lot of traders have been chased out of the market, which means there's very low open interest, which actually makes the market more volatile, not less. And it's just ripe for manipulation. Oh, and coincidentally, this is funny. The CFTC office in Chicago, they had 22 securities lawyers working at the CME office in Chicago. They fired 21 and number 22 quit. So there are no securities lawyers working at the CFTC office in Chicago where the CME is located. Oh, that's good. So there is ample fertile soil for the tinfoil hat this morning in that regard, Mr. Walsh. Thank you for supporting the channel, EJ. Only an acre 5541 says, me and my 24 friends round up 150 million, LOL. Yeah, they passed the hat around and everybody reached in their pockets for the loose change they had on them. And they came up with 150 million bucks. Poor guys, right? I guess it's good to be a private credit executive at Blackstone. What can I say? Jeez. And, you know, jeez, I hope we didn't set you back, fellas. Yeah. Meeting investor withdrawals with personal funds from the fund managers. Feels like poetic justice, but at the same time, just how bad are things in private credit? Maybe you want to sell an asset. I just throw it out there. Sell a loan. You say it's worth a lot. Freaking sell one. Oh, that's right. You can't. Thank you very much. Only an acre. Indigo Child 99 with the Dr. Burry avatar there. He says, Eisman podcast Monday on private equity and private credit risk in life insurance. Yep. You know, Steve Eisman's got a lot on his plate right now. And the fact that he's staying on top of this story, my tinfoil hat is off to you, Mr. Eisman. That was an excellent interview. He's had some really good ones. The Eisman playbook, that channel has been really, really good these last couple of months. I only started following it like maybe 3-4 months ago, but it's really fantastic. Hey, they've even had our friend Lox Ganapathy on that channel. So check out the Eisman playbook while you're at it, or the Eisman podcast if you're on Spotify. And yeah, I agree with Steve. I think private equity and private credit, and you know, when you lump in life insurance, what's happened is these private equity funds have bought life insurance companies, and they're putting the debt of their holding companies, the private credit, into the holdings of the life insurance companies, which means they're just moving the risk onto grandma's annuity. It's something we've been talking about a lot on this channel. And I am delighted to see a guy, an OG like Steve Eisman, covering that topic. Thank you, Steve, for your hard work, sir. Get well soon. Thanks again, Indigo Child. M&J741G, otherwise known as M&J, says, Ken, okay, at 8:42 a.m., M&J, can I ask Jack to post the Blackstone article link from this morning stream, please? They're trying to buy TXNM Power. Okay, I remember that. That's the New Mexico utility, right? Blackstone is trying to buy so that they can send all the power to their data centers. And it would be good for the regulators to know about this. All right, so what I'll do then after the show, Ken and M&J, I will go into the comments and I'll post the link. Sometimes YouTube deletes comments that have links, so it doesn't always work. If that doesn't work, I could always go tweet it out on Twitter. So you can go to my Twitter feed at JG_Nuke. Or look in the comments. It's going to be a couple of minutes because I have some stuff I have to do after the show. But I will get that link out to the masses. Thank you, M&J. And thank you, Ken M. I really appreciate that. And, oh, wait, we've got Madison Hypes. Okay, Madison says, what is private credit again? What types of loans? All right, so private credit, when you hear that, they're loans from not banks or non-banks, or sometimes they're called NDFIs, non-depository financial institutions. Sometimes they're called shadow banks. Oh, spooky. I like the term shadow banks because it implies that they lurk in the shadows and they don't want people to see what they're doing, and that matches them. Private credit are loans from financial firms that are not banks that are pretending to be like banks. And as I always say, yeah, let's pretend to be a bank. How hard could it be? It is incredibly hard to be a bank and to do it responsibly. And these firms have wandered into this category that after the GFC, the regulators decided too big to fail is too big of a problem to exist. And so we're not going to let the banks make these risky loans anymore. And so that created a market. You still have a demand for these loans from zombie companies, which are still being held alive by low interest rates and printed money. And so these zombie companies need somebody else to borrow for now that the banks aren't allowed to loan to them. And so along comes your Blackstones, your Apollos, your Carlyles, your KKRs, all these not banks, non-banks, these shadow banks or private credit firms now. And they're like, sure, we'll loan you the money. We don't care. It's not our money. It's our investors' money. And so they start making the loans. And then they're like, hey, you know, because we're loaning to all these desperate companies, we're actually making a lot of money on fees. We could price gouge these a-holes. But we just ran out of money to loan. Where are we going to get more? And so what they do is they turn to the real banks that are not allowed to make these loans. And they say, yo, loan us a couple of $1 billion so we can loan that $1 billion to the people you're not allowed to loan to. I shit you not. Case in point, JP Morgan, the very bank that is piloted by CEO Jamie Dimon, who coined the term cockroaches to describe fraud in private credit. JP Morgan has loaned $50 billion to private credit firms who have then taken that money and loaned it to Jamie Dimon's cockroaches. So they have created the perfect transfer mechanism. We changed the rules after the GFC. We said, you can't do that. And the market said, we still want to do it. So we'll just do it anyway, using a middleman, charging an extra fee, and the same risk and the same problem is there. We never solved the problem. When we bailed them out and we didn't let them take the losses, we guaranteed it would happen again. We said we're going to change the rules so they can't do it. They found the loophole and they did it anyway. That's private credit, Madison. And it is a multi-trillion dollar industry. M&J, thanks again, Madison, for the question. M&J says, Ken would like it posted in Discord, please. Okay, we'll get the link in Discord. Thank you, guys. He really wants that link. I'll send you the Blackstone articles from the last 2 days because we had two of these. I'll get you both of these in Discord, Ken. Thank you. Thanks again, M&J, for relaying the message. And KDM says, thanks for keeping up on Blackstone. KDM, you are most welcome. And guys, look, every now and then, I went back and I watched the stream yesterday. I even made the slip. I called Blackstone BlackRock a couple of times. Just be careful. That's an easy mistake to make when you see a story, especially if you're trying to trade it. Make sure you have your dark minerals straight. I mean, a lot of people often confuse Blackstone and BlackRock. I think one was a spinoff of the other originally, too. They are two different firms. They're just nearly identical name. But yeah, that's a thing. Thank you very much, KDM, for supporting the channel, sir. Thank you, everybody, for having your coffee with the Melonheads this morning. Don't forget that like button and that subscribe button on the way out. Don't forget your tickets for George Noble's Best Stock Ideas Summit on March 11th. Thank you guys very much for all the super chats, as well as you magnanimous Melonhead members on YouTube, Patreon, and Buy Me a Coffee. Thank you guys for supporting the channel. Links are down below should you feel so inclined. Hi, Mom. Hi, Dad. Love you guys. Everybody, till next time, live small and dream big.